This is Victoria of the UnleashedHeart.com, and you're listening to Grieving Voices, a podcast for hurting hearts who desire to be heard, or anyone who wants to learn how to better support loved ones experiencing loss. As a 30-plus year griever and advanced grief recovery method specialist, I know how badly the conversation around grief needs to change. Through this podcast, I aim to educate grievers and non-grievers alike, spread hope, and inspire compassion toward those hurting. Lastly, by providing my heart with ears and this platform, grievers have the opportunity to share their wisdom and stories of loss and resiliency. How about we talk about grief like we talk about the weather? Let's get started. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Grieving Voices. Today, my special guest is very special. It kind of feels like a big deal to me, is Christopher Kerr, Dr. Christopher Kerr. He is the Chief Medical Officer and a CEO for the Center of Hospice and Palliative Care in Buffalo, New York. To date, him and his research team at Hospice Buffalo have published multiple studies on the topic of end-of-life experience. Over 1,500 end-of-life events have been documented. And so that's what we were talking about today, is end-of-life experience, but also his grief story as well. So thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you for doing this. This is important.
So can we start where your work is rooted?
Sure. How it began in terms of medical sense or more personally?
More personal.
Yeah, I lost my father when I was 12 years old. And the last time I saw him, actually, he was certainly in a different place, inner place. And he thought that he was reenacting or re-experiencing what we did every year, which was go fishing. So he was trying to get me ready, grabbing my shirt and such, saying we had to catch a plane because we're going north. But he was smiling, and that's the last time I saw him. So I actually experienced what he ended up studying as a child. When you lose a parent at 12, it's obviously life-changing and traumatic in ways that are hard to describe. It's not something that I openly talked about or dealt with at all, actually. What happened was I inadvertently ended up at hospice, which was the last place. I was actually here trained to be a cardiologist in Buffalo, and I needed to moonlight more. And it's a long story, but because I had to carry a pager for cardiology, I couldn't work in an ER anymore. So I was doing home visits for hospice. I saw an ad in the paper, actually, and started doing it. And it was really the thing that I, this intense, painful memory of my life earlier, now I'm seeing at the end of life as I'm caring for people who are dying. Because in a more sterilized medical environment, there's a big barrier between you and the bedside, and you're knee deep in bureaucracy. And when there isn't a lot to do due to the patient, you're less involved as a physician in today's world. But when I actually had to attend to them and be present, I'm seeing it, this whole thing again. And I really never talked about what happened to me as a child. As a young boy, when I lost my father, I had a very brisk and pronounced response. I didn't mention his name, let alone that experience. Now, what happened was, I was giving a TED talk, and by this time, I had already had all this research and it was getting all this notice and whatever. And it was bothering me because it was just so dishonest, because I wasn't telling my piece of the story, right? And so I took a friend of mine who I trust out for lunch, and I said, I gotta tell you something. Here's the real truth. This is how I came into it. Because these things kind of aren't random. And so then I just, when I went to give a TED talk, I just told my piece of the story. So that was actually the first time I kind of went out there with it. But yeah.
I love the TED talk, by the way, and I will put the link in the show notes.
And so the research that you've done, how many years, first of all, how long did this take you?
It's actually a funny story. I guess it's been over a decade.
Oh, wow.
So what happened was I did it because I was really pissed off. I had nothing to do with getting this kind of attention at all. I was trying to, I teach student, medical students and residents, and they're required to do rotations through hospice for a few weeks. And I was telling them, you know, there's a side of dying, you see this objective piece, but then there's the experience of dying. And what actually the patient is experiencing. And dying is unique in that it's changing your vantage point, and it makes sense that your perspectives and your perceptions change dramatically. And this is just universal. It's been described throughout time that these people are having these very, very intense inner experiences. And, you know, we live in this evidence-based time, and doctors are ever more discomforted by things they can't measure, see, biopsy, image. And so the students would always say, you know, well, there's no evidence for that. And I said, well, yeah, it's been talked about forever, but not evidence in the way they like to see it. So I did the studies formally, and we went through a university process, had an IRB approved study. People had to consent with a witness. They were screened every day in participation. So we'd approach patients every day until death about these experiences. We had to rule out that they weren't confused and that sort of thing. And we filmed, actually, interestingly, only because we were trying. We knew that you had to see it to believe it. And people would make assumptions about these patients that they were feeble-minded or confused. And it made them look like you and I. And the film, ironically, it was meant for a medical audience, is now part of this full-length documentary. So it's funny how it turns out. So anyways, so I did that for a medical community. And, you know, now we've published probably 8 papers. And they always get published, but you don't hear a lot of noise about it. And then what happened was really, really weird. It ended up seeping out to the non-medical community starting 6-7 years ago. And honestly, we have never been able to keep up with it. It ended up on the front section, the science section of the New York Times, Washington Post, The Atlantic, Huffington Post 2 or 3 times, Scientific America, Psychology Today. But then it ended up going around the world. It was in India and China and Germany, and it never seems to stop. Korea. So the point is, and it's a sad point, is that what didn't resonate with the medical community, the people providing the care, resonates enormously with the people receiving the care. And it's the best part about the TED Talk isn't the TED Talk, it's the comments. And because the comments, people have never had this stuff really properly validated for them, and it allows them to share their stories. And I think the comments section is more interesting than TED Talk. But so it's been very interesting. There's been a framework for this discussion, and it resonates with people, and it doesn't seem to stop. So yeah, that's how it all happened. I intended one thing, and this thing just kind of went out of control.
Do you get a sense that people, I mean, obviously people are just kind of thirsty for this?
Yeah, they are. They are. And what we did that was really, really different was, and it's very, very important, is everybody who has done this historically has used it as a keyhole into the afterlife. And then that gets you into a camp that's paranormal, religious, afterlife-y, or whatever. And we didn't do any of that. All we wanted to do was capture what the patients were telling us in the dying experiences, what they were experiencing, without extrapolating or editorializing or assuming. And we just left it at what it is. And we knew that would have more appeal, because you're preaching to the choir in the paranormal world, right? And we just didn't want to do that. The idea is that dying's a mystery unto itself, period, without having to go into reincarnation or I have no idea. So we just kept it on point.
What's come to my mind is that And there's a part in your book too, where you say, and speak, I didn't mention the book, but you have a book, it's called Death is But a Dream, Finding Hope and Meaning at Life's End. And you mentioned the TED Talk, you mentioned the documentary, you know, the surviving death, but then this is going to be a documentary of its own.
It is a documentary. It's being released next week. And this part
all by itself. Yeah. The title, and it's titled Death is But a Dream, based on your book, correct?
Yep. And then it's in the rest of the country in April.
Can't wait for that.
Yeah. I'll send you
so there is a part though in your book where I have a note here, and it's dying from loneliness to a life affirming connection. So it's this dying process that takes you, it's like this life affirming experience. And you say it's for the dying as much as it is for the bereaved. Can you speak to that a little bit?
So we see dying as a physical state and suffering or lessening of the person. But what's missed in that is that there's powerful processes going on from the patient's perspective. And they're remarkably comforting and they're remarkably life affirming. And so what we did in our studies was ask them what they were experiencing. We even looked at dying as post-traumatic growth. And this idea that you could be within a negative experience of going to war, but there were gains. And what we found was really remarkable. Right up until the last day, people who are having these experiences are gaining insight and understanding and adapting. So there's this paradox where you are physically declining, but spiritually and psychologically, you're actually growing. And the direction actually affirms the life you led, because the end of life experiences focus on very, very specific things, which most notably is the powerful relationship secured and unconditionally or full of love, so that you end up feeling better. And in process, you kind of lessen the fear of dying. The bereaved piece is interesting. You know, we have studied or surveyed and interviewed 750 people. And it's just this old adage, what's good for the patient is good for the loved one. And as a bereaved person, you can view death as a decline towards nothingness and emptiness and loss. And what you find is actually there's lots of this connectivity between what the person's experiencing with how they relate to the bereaved. So an example for is, you know, a couple who have been together for 60 years and they lost a baby 55 years ago, and at the end of their lives, you know, she's re-experiencing the child, you know, holding a child or what have you, and now the spouse is looking at his partner, and that completely inverts dying as something more than empty, but actually rich with love. And how we see a person die, I mean, when you're looking at the bedside of someone you love, your concern beyond their physical comfort is, where are they and how are they? Are they okay when their eyes are closed? And what the data shows is they are, and they're not alone. And we've taken grief tools and measured grief processing, and this absolutely does help them in the grief, in the bereavement piece. You know, knowing that the person you love is reacquainted with their lost mother, it just pulls it all together, in a way that provides solace.
And I can say from experience, when my dad was dying of colon cancer when I was 8. He was sick for 2 years prior to that, but you know, that experience wasn't mine or ours, because it wasn't something that was talked about in the late 80s, obviously. How has this work helped you heal from your own loss?
We were in a similar era as children losing parents, and I'm not so sure it was done well. You know, we still do treat dying as a medical problem to address or solve, when it's really about a closing of a life. It's not about a failing body part. That's over. You know, when someone is past treatment and everything like that, people don't die in parts. They die in totality. And totality of a life is defined mostly by the relationships. So medicine takes something which is ultimately a very human experience, and they sterilize it into something that isn't. And, you know, working in hospice for 21, 22 years is interesting, because families still will come in here, their loved ones weeks before dying, and they're talking about test results or imaging. And, you know, it's absurd. It's almost a distraction to the experience of end of life, which should bring people together. Dying is lonely as it is. When we medicalize it like this, and particularly what probably you or I experience, is we're not actually brought closer to the person. Inadvertently, we're brought farther. And I think that complicates bereavement terribly. Actually, I know it does.
There is a note I have here too about over-medicalizing the process of the dying. Can you go a little bit more into depth on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated story, but we have a healthcare system. Well, first of all, the economy of healthcare is completely based on doing things to people. You get world-class interventional care as long as you're considered treatable, and then you fall off a cliff literally when there's nothing more to do to you. We have actually over-medicalized it and deprived it of its humanness, and we've inadvertently made it more lonely. And then we're shocked. We complicate bereavement terribly, because we talk about somebody who's on an obvious dying trajectory as though there's always something you can do to them. Just one more thing, then we'll take another picture next week. And really, there's a lot of data on this, particularly at tertiary. So high-end medical centers actually have less, don't add to mortality. They take from it, because this idea of medical futility doesn't seem to matter. So they take people who have clear terminal trajectories, but they keep it going. It's hard to put into words, but basically, I've been doing this work for a long time. A third of our patients are in hospice for 7 days. And that's a national number. And the hospice benefits for 6 months. The reason why most of those patients are in for 7 days is because the doctor talking to them hasn't had an honest conversation. And there's this enormous discrepancy between what the physician knows and what they actually share. And the more doctors that are involved in the case, the less they actually know. So nobody's surprised. Like, if you're a physician and you find out your patient with advanced cancer is dead, and you hear about it, you're not surprised. You probably didn't tell the patient family when. So there's not a lot of information shared. I always tell a story. We live by a major cancer center, and I can tell you the people who come into our hospice facility here know where to park there, how much it costs to get a coffee there, but they don't know when or how they're going to die. And it's actually not that difficult to prognosticate, but people just don't have the discussions. So we're left traumatized, because it's treated, dying in a medical environment is treated like an acute event. The only thing that's acute is the sudden awareness and ability to finally tell somebody. A lot of our patients, this is sad, end up making their own call to come out into hospice out of desperation. And imagine the courage that takes when the doctor could have helped them in the transition. So nearly, almost a half of dying people visit an ER in the last 1 to 3 months of life, because that's the only place they're recognized. But it's, it's an absurd, we've become ever more death denying.
I would agree with that in the work that I do with grief recovery.
Well, what you see on the bereavement side, which is a whole other topic, which we're doing some work on here, you'd be very interested in, is this notion of medical harm. I have a theory that we complicate bereavement because we don't help well enough loved ones come to the understanding that this is where their loved one is at. And we don't have honest conversations about what the dying process is going to look like. what their loved one's going to need in their care. And so what we do is there's a void filled of unknowns, and the family tends to assume the worst. They're just crippled with fear for pain and all these symptoms that are really 99% of the time easy to manage, but we don't have those discussions. So there's a lot of data on prognostication, but in general, doctors get it wrong and they over-prognosticate by a factor of 2 to 3. And what that does is, yeah, it's interesting. You should look it up. How accurate are doctors prognosticating in the play? And because there's huge implications for bereavement, because loss is enormously, it's one of the biggest challenges you'll face in your life is the loss of somebody you love. So you can either be brought into that openly and honestly and process and adapt and address and all those things, or you can be all of a sudden faced with this brutal reality and injured, and it complicates how you recover. So doctors inadvertently do a lot of harm by not being honest. And we're constantly pulling out people from the hospital who are, you know, there's not a chance in hell they're living, but they're still in this process of acute medicine under the delusion that they're going to do well. And as I said, the irony is you go to the highest medical centers in the world, they actually live less long for all the processing. So it's actually the inversion.
And what's the quality of that life that's left? That's the thing.
The data until recently is very interesting, which is the vast majority, 70% of Americans want to die at home, and 70% of Americans don't. And that's really interesting. That's changed, particularly with COVID, because people are fearful of going into hospitals and facilities.
Yeah, my dad passed away in the nursing home. Living in a rural area where we do, there isn't actually access to hospice. My mom cared for him as long as she could. She just felt like he needed more than what she could give him medically, right? Because there's always this hope of something working or something helping, or, you know, to take his pain away or anything like that. And I thought of a question, and it might be really deep. I don't know, but do you think that there is, like, when I think about your work and the work that you've done, and I think about how, you know, some people want to just die suddenly, like they don't want to know what hit them. But I think there's a beautiful gift in having the gift of time, that knowing that you have this diagnosis, you know that there's a bookend, you don't know when, but that you have some control over how you live the rest of your days. I think there's a gift in that. I'm curious what your thoughts are on how people have, like people that have been in your care, like, do they regret the suffering that they've had to go through to have these experiences? Or, and I don't imagine they do, but I don't know. Maybe I don't even know how I'm asking this, but.
No, I haven't met the person. I haven't met the person that didn't want control of their own life, even in the face of death, that didn't want to be informed, that didn't want to be protected or denied from their own realities by somebody. I've never met the person. You know, it's funny because people think, oh, you know, they don't want to know. They all want to know. It's their body. It's their life. It's not working the same. They can't stand up anymore. You know, there's intuition. Just they're in that body. So the denial actually is harmful. So yeah, they want to know, and they need to close their life. There's things they want to say, there's people they want to connect to. And there's beauty in a lot of it because it reduces our relationships to what matters. So you stop worrying about your tax bill, but boy, you want to hold that grandchild. Like there's richness in it. It's part of an understandable process. It's less about, again, the organs not working here and there. It's really about, you know, dimming the light on your life and reflecting. and validating who you are and what you've lived for. And generally what happens is fascinating. So when we don't have a perspective on this, because trying to understand a dying person's perspective is too big of a reach. But I can tell you a few things happen, is that at the time of diagnosis, there's obviously all that trauma and it's very self-focused, you know, as it should be. What happens though when people realize they're dying, their concerns go to others. And that's a very, very important part of dying. It's all these gestures and love given and things said to people they care about. And they should never be denied that opportunity. It's really, really important part of this kind of letting go idea is that they can reconnect with people they love. It's this idea of almost being put back together before the end. And it really matters. And sometimes it's just to be forgiven or just to forgive. Sometimes it's just to express love or to remember. But it's reconnecting and reuniting. It's less of a dismantling process, dying, than it is putting back together process. And it's all of that is good stuff that affirms life and it doesn't deny life. So dying is interesting because, you know, we try to protect the dying from their own experience in a way, when really we should be engaging with them in it. We used to do this more naturally, but we've taken the medicalization of it to the point that we focus on a medical paradigm rather than a human one, and they're very different.
I interviewed a woman who has had metastatic breast cancer for 17 years. And, you know, she said, well, I'm considered an outlier. And there's another woman in a group that she's a part of who's lived with metastatic breast cancer for 25 years. And of course it wouldn't be from, you know, it's Western medicine is obviously a huge contribution to their extended time, but there's also hope. And so do you feel like in the work that you've been doing, is it because they come to you, it's usually closer to the end, like they've not given up hope, but maybe it's been transformed for them? Like, how do you see hope in the work that you do?
Yeah, I don't see people, hope doesn't ever go away. And what you hope for changes. And so when you're in the struggle with your disease, the attitude should be always hope for the very best, like, you know, an unusual recovery or protracted life, but also prepare for the worst. That duality of approach is really the most graceful way through these kind of illnesses, is you don't deny the fact that, you know, this could go the other direction, but boy, hope and fight like hell that, you know, you're going to live and live well. The people that I take care of, their hope, actually, I think in some ways is stronger, but they're hoping for something else. They're hoping for a peaceful end. They're hoping for dignity. They're hoping for autonomy. They're hoping to reconnect with people they love. They hope they're going to have the opportunities to say what they want to say to who they need to say it to. It becomes much more of a giving gesture than it is worried about. You know, if you're unloaded of that whole stress and weight of survival or not, and you've already kind of crossed over, how it changes people's paradigm thought is really fascinating. But hope is still there. It's just hoping for something else.
I love that.
You know, that's why people, I'll tell you, it's interesting. I talk about this in the end of the book, but one of the more interesting things, when we first started writing the university or appealing the university to do these studies, we were denied because, you know, we want to sterilize the dying and put them on a shelf and don't interfere with them kind of thing, you know, which is actually the worst thing because their dying's lonely and they're looking at a white ceiling. And so what's fascinating is that everybody in that book is who they are and in the film, and not one person who was approached and denied to participate. That's a hell of a lot of people between the film and the book. And And they're telling the real stories of their lives, like the hard stuff. And so you've got to ask yourself, okay, well, there's no secondary gain. Some of the people who are participating are literally days or weeks from dying. And so why are they doing this? Why are they spending their precious time and energy? And it's because they're still human. And that means they still want to have meaning. They still want to be heard. Still want to have relevancy. They still want to connect. And that never goes, even though they're going to be dead. Like, they know there's finality, but it's part of our human condition that we, it's defined by our ability to relate to others, to discuss and to talk and to be heard and to hear back. And that never goes away. So that there's hope in that as well. Hope that you matter. And it's really a subplot within that book.
Do you find, or have you been contacted about from different places around the country? Because like I said, you know, hospice care is very difficult to come by in a lot of places. Do you see that starting to change?
Hospices?
Just the access to hospice care. Yeah. And just
It's unfortunately, since I started, there were very few for-profits. And like in New York, it's licensed by the state, and there's only one in every county. There's 5,500 or something hospices in the United States.
Wow.
Yeah, and one of the initiatives is to improve the access to rural areas. And I actually think it's going to happen more. We're seeing more of it because of telehealth, ability to meet people remotely. Because there's just the practicality of having on-call systems and access to people who are distant, but we're getting better. And there's a lot of incentivized, grants and dollars on the table to do that. You know, the payer system's now asking, you know, how are you going to get to our members over here? And that's exactly what they should be saying.
Well, that gives me hope.
Yeah.
So the patients that have come to you for end of life care, the significance, I imagine you kind of spoke to this, for the bereaved, and that's kind of where I'd like to take this conversation next, is those who are left behind. Has it really shifted, or have you seen shifts in people's perspectives about what they then want for themselves?
It's a great question. Yeah, not measurably, but certainly anecdotally. Yeah, it's interesting. This is in the film. There's a number of people who speak very clearly about this. And more what it does is it informs them of what, from the experience, they learn that their fear of death is less, definitely.
Mm.
And I think that matters a lot, because of all the symptoms of dying, fear is actually probably come close to the top of the list. And they end up more with a faith that the story is not as bad as feared, you know? And that again, that really comes out in the film really, really well. I actually think the family members are as moving as the patients, not more so in some ways. You know, there's a lady in the film, for example, whose mother has very advanced dementia, and she's in a nursing home facility. And the weeks prior to her death, she's trying to escape all the time, but she's happy as could be. And what was happening was the daughter would go and see her every day, and she was having these rich, meaningful dreams about her deceased husband. And they had this kind of fairy tale marriage of love. And so what's happening, the dreams are so real to her and vivid that she's acting on. And she's trying to leave the building because she's always thinks she's going to go, has to get to the church to meet her husband to get married. And this happened right up until like the last days of life. So here she is, and this is the paradox of it all, is that she's losing her life, but she's actually reliving the best day of her life. And it was in that mindset that she died, that she was euphoric, you know, this notion of living again with her, the one she loved. So what that does to the daughter is completely changes her perception of loss.
It gives them an opportunity to open up that conversation, I imagine, because otherwise, would that have happened, you know?
Yeah, right, because people tend to need permission to have these sort of conversations. And you're right, yeah, it does. Would it happen? Yeah, you don't know. Or would she just be medicated? Which actually happens a lot. Yeah, it's a good point.
So what would you tell somebody who is watching their loved one suffer and they're not sure what to do? What do you advise people?
You don't have to do this alone, first of all. Most of America, you can get help, and it's specialized help, which is hospice help. I worry that people in their caregiving is fascinating, and that people will describe it as the best, hardest thing they've ever done. So there's great human value in stopping your life and becoming the caregiver, but it shouldn't be done as though you're alone with it. And so getting help like hospice, which was designed for the home, is really, really, really advisable. And again, most people in the nation have it. You know, in terms of this kind of work, it's really giving people permission you've got to almost give them a framework, the idea that this happens, you know, that people nearing the end of life, their sleep cycle changes, the architecture of sleep changes, their level of alertness changes. Dying is progressive sleep. Nobody dies awake. And, it's really two things. You eat less and you sleep more. And in that state of sleep, a lot of people have these very intense experiences, and don't be afraid of them. That doesn't mean it's drugs or that their disease has gone to their brain, and ask questions and allow it to occur. Give it the space to occur, because it provides comfort and meaning. You know, nearly 90% of our patients, if you follow them daily, report at least one event. But it has value.
As a teenager, I worked in a nursing home. So obviously, you know, a lot of people pass away and things, and they never really talked about or explained, or you don't really get educated on the process of the dying. You just kind of learn on the job. And one of the things that really stuck out to me that I still remember, and I saw it too, and when I did home health, because there was a few, I had some clients that were on hospice at home, and they do this thing, they called it picking. Now, I don't know, maybe you can clarify for me, but what is actually happening when someone is, you know, reaching into the air? And
so it's a great question. It's a whole area of interest of mine. So it was actually, those actions were actually named by Hippocrates. So it's always been known. And basically what happens, if you take somebody who goes into delirium, confusional states, it's often because their sleep cycle is completely disarranged. And for example, if you went to bed tonight and I woke you up every 2 hours for 3 or 4 days, your dreams would become very intense. And so they become virtual. So in a nursing home, it's universal. You'll see it, particularly sundowning hours, because that has to do with our day-night cycle. You'll see people either looking right through you or grabbing for things or playing with their sheets or wanting to get up. And because they're in their dream, they're participants in their dream. So they think that thing's in front of them. The dreams are normally, you don't normally dream that you're just lying still. You're doing something. So they'll say they've got to get up. And that's why a lot of elderly people fall in the night. I've seen people without legs, forget they don't have legs because they're dreaming of something when they were younger. Then they get up. So those are very, very common things that happen in delirium or confusional states.
Yeah. So it's not part of the dying process.
No. Although a lot of people who are dying become delirious, but typically towards the end.
Okay.
And oftentimes, because there's unmanaged symptoms, and it could be something just like constipation or nausea. When you have the flu, the one common denominator of all illness is this pull to go to bed and to sleep. You know, I mean, you don't go climb a mountain, you go, I just want to crawl under the covers and I want to sleep. And then something interferes with that sleep. Anything. That sets the stage for confusional states. So let's say you got the flu. Have you ever had the flu?
Mm-hmm.
And you want to go to bed and alarm clock goes up every hour. Have you had a child?
Mm-hmm.
Have you, been postpartum and you've gone days without sleep and you're hearing the noises and the baby crying, whatever, and you're pretty close. Now you imagine you're 80 and you have that level of sleep disruption. Then they get confused. It's why it's used as a form of torture and war. Mm-hmm. Just keep waking somebody. Everybody will get confused. And one of the pieces of confusion is that the dreams become, you're in your dream. And the themes become horrific, the worse it is. Just like your mood becomes worse with missing one night's sleep. Now you're adding, 4 and 5. And then, you think there's a fire, somebody's robbing you, you're paranoid of the person giving your care. So that whole dissolving of the mind is very, very tied to sleep. And they're basically dreaming with their eyes open when they're doing those things. It's why very nice people can become combative in a nursing home. And tragically, they often need to be tied up. It's why you try to keep elderly people out of the hospital. You keep them in their home and they can live a lot longer. As soon as you put them in the hospital and you start waking them up in the night, then they can't go, they end up confused.
That's fascinating. Never really thought of that. Yeah. I never really thought about that, but yeah.
Yeah. You can take an elderly person who can put themselves in context because everything's familiar. They know where the nightstand is and then they go to a hospital and then somebody wakes them up to give them a pill and they wake up and they're disoriented and they're not sure where's my nightstand. And that's untying them. And I'm caring for my mother now in Northern Ontario and she's 88 and you have to be very careful waking her up because it takes a lot for her to pull herself back together. And she'll ask questions like, why are these people in the room? And da, da, da. 10 minutes later, she's fine. But sleep is really the fifth vital sign for elderly people. And if you don't protect it well, you can confuse them all.
Interesting. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, that's
very helpful, I think, for many listeners who are the caregivers for their loved ones right now.
Yeah, our alarm goes off about sleep more than anything else. Because as soon as you have an elderly person who's starting to not have fragmented sleep, it's going to be very hard to keep their mind together.
So where is this? I mean, it's been a long time since you've started this research, and is it starting to morph into another area of interest for you?
We wanted this to go away about 5 years ago, but the momentum for it keeps going. So we keep doing the work. We've extended this, right? We've looked at children who are having these experiences. And there's a chapter in the book about that. We've done a lot of work, obviously, with the bereaved and looking at how that's changed them. The next thing we're working on that I'm personally interested in is this caregiving idea. Because if you do what we do, it's so inspiring to see. There's a really great story about how people rise up and the strength and the courage to care for their loved one and really focus their life back to that pivotal relationship. And how that influences bereavement in a good way. If they've been allowed to have the time to reconnect with that person. So that's the story we're trying to uncover.
Yeah, and the first thing that comes to my mind is support. Like the caregivers need that support. And I think that's lacking with a lot of corporate jobs, the supporting the care, person that is employed that's supporting a caregiver with time off or, things like that. I just think that's something that's not really being addressed quite yet. I don't think we're quite there in caregiver support yet.
And within the developed world, we offer as a country far less than half any other nation in terms of assistance in the home. So helping the caregiver be a caregiver. So again, world-class care in a hospital, very little care at home where you're actually going to live with your illness.
Right. And it's very expensive. The organization that I worked for, I'm not even sure what it costs for people to have me come into the home, but I've heard things that it's very expensive and it's out of pocket. And that's why people end up in the nursing home and things like that, because you can't afford home help. Mm-mm. And so then either too, as a caregiver, as a child of a parent who's ill and sick and things like that, you have to choose then between your job, your livelihood, your family and things like that. And that's why you see a lot of parents moving in, you know, a lot of these combined families now, the parent moving in with the child and their family. And
yeah,
and that dynamic too, there isn't a lot of support there.
No,
I would love to see your research expand into that.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. And we're starting to film the people as well as we're going along, because it just seemed to coincide well with the first book. So where we had the research, we had the film, and we had the book, and it all kind of came together in a good way.
Well, and there's a lot of grief too that is there with when there isn't support as well.
Yeah, and the other thing we're looking at and we're doing some studies on, again, is this idea of the care before death, care of the family before death, how that affects grief. So back to our earlier conversation, if you were included in the process, if you were informed accurately, if you were given time, real time, not denied, and reassured, what does that do as opposed to being there in the hospital for a month and then the guy says all of a sudden this is the end? And this idea of help versus harm pre-death and how that affects bereavement, because I see people who almost have PTSD after these losses, after an extended stay in a hospital they really didn't know, and they're still hopeful until the last 24 hours. And there's a lot there. So how well are we caring for the loved ones of the dying patient? And it's very interesting, because if you ask the patient, that's what their concern is, their loved ones. And particularly, during COVID, it's obviously different, but people are so disconnected. People are saying goodbye over technology.
Yeah, I've heard some really tragic stories about that, where it just feels so incomplete. I just want to read a little part here that ties into what you just said. It's in your book on page, it's found the chapter on To Those Left Behind. When the dying patient becomes absorbed in and then comforted by their end-of-life experiences, it changes the context of dying from loneliness to a life-affirming connection. And this is as significant for the bereaved as it is for the dying. That was kind of that point that I brought up earlier. And I highlighted that because I think it is such a poignant point to make, in that it is as much for the bereaved, like you said, as it is for the dying. And I've just reflected on my loss and my father and what he went through and how he was denied that. You know, he was denied a good death, I would say. You know, I would call it a good death. I don't know. It just kind of makes me feel like, the trade-off is the suffering and maybe the pain, but like you said, that's manageable. And so where do you draw the line in, and how do you assess that when someone to manage what they're experiencing, but yet ensuring that they can still have a lucid experience?
Yeah. I mean, it is a fine line. And the patient should direct it. And oftentimes what it is more than anything is they're tired and no, I need to sleep kind of thing. But it usually doesn't have to be a trade-off between pain management and wakefulness. It's almost like a Hollywood notion of pain, that you're going to need this huge dose of morphine and you're not going to be awake anymore. if you've managed pain properly all along, you've gained tolerance to those side effects of the drugs typically. People who are extraordinarily lucid on huge doses of medicine for pain, but they didn't take it all at once one day. They took it slowly and they got used to it like you would alcohol. So I don't think the two things are necessarily incompatible at all.
That gives me hope too.
The people who hold off pain medicine because they want to preserve their cognition, their ability to be alert and think, actually do the opposite, because nothing takes away your ability to think clearly and have a good mood than pain and not sleeping.
That's a good point.
So if you were to ask me, I've done this for decades, the side effects of any medicine versus the consequences of unmanaged pain or nausea, there's no question. So the interesting thing is people who decline that sort of treatment for pain medicine, you know, I don't want that to the very end, they fulfill their own prophecy. They don't want to be confused. They want to be in control, and they become less able to do both, because if you have unremitting nausea and unremitting pain, you don't sleep. And if you don't sleep well in the setting of sickness, you're miserable and you start withdrawing from conversations and meaningful participation. It's harder to smile or laugh or enjoy anybody or anything.
And you get delirious.
You get delirious. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very good point too. I absolutely love this paragraph. End of life makes visible the kind of light that signifies introspection and reflection, and that goes on shining in darkness, even after grief is turned from a single event into a lifelong journey. It is a light that radiates far and wide and is felt when all language fails us. That's beautiful. I love that. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
I particularly love, too, the story of Sierra in your book. You just want to briefly share a little bit about that story for my audience?
Yeah, she's actually on film. That's all captured on film in the documentary. So very quickly, she was in her 20s and had a child, and she had undiagnosed colon cancer for too long a period of time and was in our inpatient unit dying, but was not accepting that she was dying at all. And just asking when she's going to get better so she can get back to the hospital to get more treatment. And we were frustrated because we were concerned for the family who doesn't understand a child who wasn't getting the care he needed. And the doctor in the room finally says, you know, Sierra, are you having any dreams? And she just goes, Grandpa. And meanwhile, she'd been dreaming of her grandfather. The doctor says, what does he say? He goes, I've done a good job, you know, but that I need to stop fighting and that I'm going to be okay. And that broke everything. And of course, there's this link between the mother, that's her father who's being referred to, and this idea that she wasn't alone in this process and that she was comforting. And then there were more honest conversations about being actually at end of life and all the obstacles. But the answers didn't come from us. It came from within her. And that's on film. It's amazing.
Thank you for sharing that. I just thought it tied into beautifully what that paragraph said. So thank you for sharing that. Is there anything else you would like to share?
No, it's been great. Good questions.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here. If people would like to reach out to you, where can they find you?
Oh, it's Dr. Dr. Christopher Kerr, KERR.com.
Perfect. And I'll put everything in the show notes as well.
Yeah, and it's good because there's links to videos of patients and families. So it's really good to see.
Awesome. And don't forget the book, Death is But a Dream.
Yep.
I will also link to that.
Thank you.
Thank you again for your time today. And
hey there, thank you so much for listening to this episode with Dr. Chris Kerr. I have no doubt that you are walking away with some really good nuggets, and please share this episode with someone you know or love who could use his wisdom today. I just want to share, too, that this episode is dedicated to my father, Willard Becker, who passed away tomorrow on the date that this episode will go live, 34 years ago. And it is dedicated to him because this is a full circle time in my life, because I've been a griever since March 31st, 1987, when he passed away. And he did not have a good death that I feel all of us deserve and could have, right, if we maybe are lucky enough to have this experience of end of life. And it's really turned on its head this idea I had about how I wish to exit this world. Currently finishing up my end of life doula training, and it's really brought to light a lot of introspection and has changed my perspective of end of life in several ways that I plan to speak to and about more in upcoming episodes. But again, thank you for listening. And I love you, Dad. When you unleash your heart, you unleash your life. Much love. From my heart to yours, thank you for listening. If you like this episode, please share it, because sharing is caring. And until next time, give and share compassion by being a heart with ears. And if you're hurting, know that what you're feeling is normal and natural. Much love, my friend.